Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. To listen to Business Movers 1 week early and ad-free, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. It's July 1955 at the Disneyland theme park in Anaheim, California. An overexcited 11-year-old George Lucas and his father wait in the Tomorrowland spaceport. It's the first week of the park's opening, and young George is in heaven. 90 million people watch the park's first day live on television. Now George can't believe he's actually here in person. He's gone on all the rides and is now in line to enter the futuristic Rocket to the Moon attraction. He stares up at the 72-foot-high TWA Moonliner rocket, awed by its size. Does that thing really go into space, Dad?
No, George, it's just an illusion, but I'm sure the experience will be very realistic. I'd like to go to space someday. Well, if you apply yourself a bit harder in school, spend less time watching television, I'm sure there's no limit to what you can achieve.
George's TV habit is starting to worry George Sr., who thinks his son needs to focus on his studies before his grades start slipping.
You think there are aliens on the moon? Like on the planet Mongo? Mongo? Where's that, George? It's where Flash Gordon travels when he conquers the universe. I don't know anything about Flash Gordon, George. How did Mr. Disney come up with all the ideas for these rides?
Oh, I'm sure he didn't do it alone.
He has a talented team working hard to ensure everything runs exactly how he wants.
Walt Disney wanted Disneyland to be the happiest place on Earth for adults and children. But the park's opening was plagued with long lines, broken rides, and faulty plumbing. Today, though, George didn't notice any problems. He's swept up in the awe and wonder of the place.
Hey, Dad, after we get off the moon ride, can we go back to Autotopia?
You love your cars, don't you, George?
It's my favorite ride so far. I want to be a race car driver when I grow up.
George, you need to focus on your studies. Leave the dreaming to Mr. Disney, don't you think? Why is he the only one who gets to dream?
Walt Disney's theme parks would forever hold a special place in George's heart. His joy at driving the Autotopia racetrack would foreshadow his love affair with cars. And the rocket to the moon would point the way to another of George's lifelong obsessions. George Sr. would make the trip to Disneyland an annual holiday treat for the Lucas family. And later in life, George would continue the tradition when he had a family of his own. And as he grew up, George Lucas saw a lot of himself in Walt Disney. Walt claimed that he didn't make movies to make money, but that he made money in order to make movies. George would come to feel the same way. His Star Wars profits were always plowed straight into the next film or his own personal theme park, Skywalker Ranch. And as Star Wars grew into a global phenomenon, it was inevitable that one day, the Disney Corporation would come calling. In 1984, Disney executives approached George about becoming head of film production. George was already exhausted by the rigors of running his own company, Lucasfilm. He knew he wasn't cut out to become another corporation's employee. Instead, George gave Disney something else, a film and a theme park ride. George co-wrote and produced the short film Captain EO, which debuted in September 1986 at Epcot in Florida's Disney World. The film was directed by George's old mentor, Francis Ford Coppola, and featured the biggest pop star on the planet, Michael Jackson. It only ran 17 minutes, but cost $10 million, the same as the first Star Wars movie, making it one of the most expensive movies per minute ever made. And it was a huge hit, playing at Disney parks for over a decade. After the success of Captain EO, Disney approached George with another idea. Star Tours, a motion simulator ride based on George's Star Wars films. With George's support, Disney Imagineers spent millions to purchase 4 military-grade flight simulators. Meanwhile, George's special effects team at ILM produced visually stunning flight sequences that would be projected inside the simulators. In all, the ride would cost $32 million, almost twice what Walt Disney spent to build Disneyland in 1955. When the ride opened to the public in January 1987, Star Wars fans poured into the park, many dressed as their favorite characters.
The ride would remain a big attraction and a big moneymaker until 2010. The debut of its replacement, Star Tours: The Adventure Continues, in 2011, would lead to a historic meeting that would change George's life forever and spark an angry controversy between George and Disney that rumbles on to this day.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. With the Star Wars trilogy finally complete, George's franchise was the king of the box office. The trilogy's cumulative haul of $1.4 billion was unmatched, dwarfed only by its merchandising sales of $2.6 billion. But the costs of running a rapidly growing company, combined with the lavish spending on George's filmmaker's retreat, Skywalker Ranch, meant that those profits were already dwindling. Lucasfilm was no longer a small, independent company. It now had hundreds of employees with annual overheads approaching $20 million. To add to the pressure, George's divorce with his wife Marcia in 1983 left Lucasfilm in a precarious situation. With no new Star Wars films on the horizon, George knew the franchise was on a downward trajectory. Kenner had shut down its toy line in 1985. Marvel had ended its 9-year comic book run of Star Wars stories a year later, and the official fan club had dwindled from a high of 184,000 members to just 5,000. To save Lucasfilm, George had to be ruthless. He would slash Lucasfilm's overheads by divesting the firm of unprofitable divisions, and he would hand over the leasing of their proprietary digital editing equipment to an outside sales firm. To earn more money, George would make ILM an effect shop for hire to all of Hollywood. In addition, George spun off his graphics division and their Pixar computer technology and put it on the market. George couldn't see a future for Lucasfilm and computer animation, but he hoped others would. But George struggled to find a buyer for Pixar at his $35 million valuation. Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple, saw an opportunity. Desperate to be rid of the company, Lucasfilm sold Jobs the Pixar technology for just $5 million. As George watched Pixar go on to huge success, he would deeply regret the decision. In 2006, Jobs would sell Pixar to Disney for $7.4 billion. But even after selling it off, George would continue to refer to Pixar as his company. But for all George's cost-cutting measures, it still wasn't enough. The simplest answer to Lucasfilm's financial issues always pointed in one direction: more Star Wars movies. George had always claimed that there were at least 6 stories in the saga, but he refused to make them until the technology caught up with his imagination. He was never satisfied with the first 3 films, feeling they had fallen short of his vision. The turning point came in 1992 when Steven Spielberg hired ILM to create realistic dinosaurs for his next movie, Jurassic Park. George would describe the moment he and Steven saw ILM's test footage of digitally created dinosaurs as a cinematic equivalent of the invention of the light bulb. The event left both men in tears at the possibilities and would portend a historic change in movie making. For George, this was the moment when the world of visual effects finally matched his ambitions. But before he would commit to a new series of Star Wars movies, he would need to prove that the technology could do exactly what he wanted it to do. This is episode 4 in our 4-part series on George Lucas, The Empire. It's the fall of 1996 at George Lucas's office in Skywalker Ranch. George has been joined by Bill Mechanic, the chairman and CEO of Fox Filmed Entertainment, the parent company of 20th Century Fox, distributors of George's original Star Wars trilogy. George is still in business with Fox as they're paying for the restoration of the original trilogy before its re-release in theaters. But this conversation is about something else. Studios in Hollywood are abuzz with the news that George's prequel trilogy is in the final stages of pre-production, and they're all vying to get the lucrative distribution rights. There are rumors that George is seriously considering offers from Disney and DreamWorks, Steven Spielberg's new movie company. Bill Mechanic is here to ensure that Fox doesn't lose Star Wars to a competitor. So, George, how's the restoration coming? I guess these will be your director's cut, right? I like to think of them as a director's wish. You know, I was never happy with how the original films looked. Plus, the condition of the negatives was terrible. Well, I can't wait to see what you've achieved. What ILM did with Jurassic Park was just extraordinary. And I wanted to thank you for giving Fox the opportunity to come along with you on this journey. Well, I appreciate you giving me the money to make it possible. When George began touting the idea of re-releasing the original Star Wars trilogy in a special edition, he let Hollywood know that he was looking for backers. Fox jumped at the chance to renew their business partnership with George, and they plunked down $15 million for the privilege. To be honest, Bill, it wouldn't have seemed right to send those movies back out without that iconic 20th Century Fox fanfare at the start. Well, we're hoping a lot of people will hear it. We're going to spend millions on advertising and open big, over 2,000 screens. I'm glad to hear it. Bill smiles for a moment before getting to the heart of the matter. But, George, tell me about the new trilogy. It's coming along nicely. I hear you're planning to go all digital. It's the future of cinema, Bill. The restorations will prove the technology is fit for the purpose. And then I can dive straight into making new movies exactly how I see them when I'm writing the scripts. No compromises. Bill leans into his pitch. Well, you know Fox is behind you and your vision. And you need us too, George. With overseas box office now accounting for at least 50% of a movie's revenue, you need a powerful worldwide operation, putting your film out there. And we're that. So I'd like to know, what's it going to take for Fox to secure the next trilogy? Well, what profit percentage do you want on gross receipts, Bill? 25% if you're anybody else. But you're George Lucas. So how about 15? How about 7.5? And $80 million to secure the exclusive rights. All right, anything else? You still have rights to the first Star Wars movie. You've had them for 20 years. I want them back. Oh, George, no. Be reasonable. The video cassette sales alone bring in millions. Bill, the next trilogy will earn billions. If you don't want a piece of that, I can go straight to Disney. It's up to you. Bill knew every studio in town wanted the next set of Star Wars movies, and he wasn't about to let it slip away. So in the end, he gave George exactly what he wanted, including the rights to the original Star Wars movie. With the deal done, George focused his attention on finishing the restoration. The conflict between George's imagination and the reality of making movies meant that he had been forced to compromise from day one. But computer graphics could now fix the flaws that had so irritated George and continue to irk him in the original Star Wars movies. A return to the original trilogy would be both a proving ground of the latest digital technology and a 20th anniversary celebration. With ILM now world leaders in computer graphics, George returned to the trilogy with a new vigor, aiming to restore the original prints before revising and enhancing a few dozen shots per film. He wanted to clean up poor quality effects, improve the look of some aliens, and maybe add in a few previously deleted scenes. But once George started, his perfectionism meant he couldn't leave the job half done. He was determined to improve every technical aspect of the movies. In the end, George would instruct ILM to make over 300 changes to the series, most of them barely noticeable, but one in particular caused fury among Star Wars diehards and marked a turning point in the relationship between George and his fans. In the first Star Wars movie, George had the smuggler Han Solo kill the bounty hunter Greedo in cold blood.
in the new restoration, George added in a laser blast that made it appear Greedo shot first. Han had gone from being the aggressor to merely acting in self-defense. George liked the morality of the revision. But the subsequent outcry over the change spawned a motto, Han shot first. And vociferous fans decried George's revisionism, accusing him of desecrating their childhood memories. The level of fury surprised and upset George. Still, the outcry wasn't enough to dampen the global demand to see Star Wars on a big screen all over again. George released the restored trilogy in early 1997. He designated the film's episodes 4, 5, and 6 in preparation for his new prequel series. The re-release of the trilogy was a triumphant hit. It alone would see gross of over $35 million on its opening weekend, easily covering the cost of the restoration. But even better for George, the film reclaimed its place as the highest-grossing film of all time, overtaking Steven Spielberg's hit E.T. In their ongoing friendly rivalry, George had beaten his friend Steven again. Despite any fan backlash, George had his answer to whether the world wanted more Star Wars. They absolutely did. And more importantly, it looked like the technology was up to the job. But if George thought the complaints over the restored trilogy were a surprise, then he was in for an even bigger shock when fans saw the prequels. George had begun thinking about the storylines for episodes 1 through 3 while ILM worked on the original trilogy restoration. Emboldened by the hope that the digital filmmaking would bring his fertile imagination to life, George created a host of new worlds, and perhaps more importantly, new characters to license and merchandise. As George wrestled with his new stories, a wave of firms were desperate to join him on his journey into a galaxy far, far away. Back when he began his intergalactic saga, George had the foresight to imagine a line of Star Wars toys. At a time when movie merchandise was seen as simply a promotional tie-in, George had recognized that Star Wars toys would extend the lifespan of his film, giving his movies a life beyond the inside of a movie theater. But in the process of the first film's negotiations, exclusive toy rights had been mistakenly signed away for life to just one toy maker, Kenner. It was a mistake that had infuriated George and cost him millions. In the intervening years, Kenner had been swallowed up by the multinational conglomerate Hasbro, who were now keen to capitalize on a new set of Star Wars movies by exercising their in-perpetuity rights. But George had a shock in store for Hasbro when he revealed that their contract was now null and void. A forgotten clause stipulated that Lucasfilm be paid an annual check of $10,000 to retain their rights. But in the process of Hasbro buying Kenner, and with the general downturn in Star Wars toy sales, that clause had been overlooked, and no checks had been sent in years. Hasbro, desperate to retain the rights, was forced to re-enter negotiations with George. From the original 2.5% cut of toy sales, Lucasfilm renegotiated for a much higher 18.5%. The contract also required Hasbro to pay a guarantee of $590 million over the life of the 10-year agreement. Hasbro executives nicknamed the new contract George's Revenge. And Hasbro wasn't the only toy company who wanted in on the action. In all, 75 licensees were lined up for official tie-ins, including, for the first time, the Danish toy company LEGO. Their participation would result in $2 billion worth of LEGO toys sold in 1999 and 2000 alone. In stark contrast to Kenner's empty boxes in 1977, the world was gearing up for a Star Wars merchandising blitz. Now all George had to do was make the movies. Emboldened by the growing sense that Star Wars was being eagerly welcomed back into the mainstream, George pushed ahead with pre-production of the prequels. Previously, when restoring the original trilogy, ILM had struggled to turn around 350 new effect shots. With the new movies, George handed them an even more daunting task, 2,200 shots, and George wanted this to be their finest work. But there was one issue George couldn't yet resolve. He wanted his new series to be shot in digital too, so he could manipulate the images immediately once it got to the post-production stage. But high-definition camera technology wasn't quite ready, so begrudgingly, George shot Episode 1 on film. The digital revolution would have to wait a little bit. Lucasfilm bore the full $115 million cost of Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. George had originally budgeted his film at $50 million, but just as before, his vivid imagination came at a price. The first signs that George's investment was secure, though, came in March 11, 1999, when the film's trailer debuted on the internet. Within the space of 5 days, it had been downloaded 3.5 million times. Steve Jobs declared it the biggest download event in history. 2 months later, The Phantom Menace opened on 7,700 screens on May 19, 1999. It was no surprise when box office records began tumbling. By the end of its first week, The Phantom Menace had already made $132 million, and it closed out the year with a colossal take of $926 million. But it was not quite enough to become the highest-grossing film of all time. George had relinquished that honor to James Cameron's Titanic the previous year. But it wasn't all good news. The fans, who felt so betrayed by George's tinkering with the restorations, returned, and even louder. George had never paid much attention to critics in the media, but now he was being attacked by a new, much larger army of detractors who mostly lived online. Their biggest complaint was Jar Jar Binks, the first computer-generated supporting character in a live-action film in history. Jar Jar was supposed to provide comic relief in the film. George had created him as a tribute to a beloved Disney character, Goofy. But the homage was lost on the dissenters, who hated his oafish, clumsy antics. But despite the online outcry, the prequels confirmed to George that the world was ready for Star Wars' return. George's flirtation with the digital realm and the restorations would now find its full flourish in Episode II, Attack of the Clones. It would be filmmaking without film, with everything shot in high-definition video and backdrops wholly created in a computer. The actors would stand on empty sound stages, leaving it to ILM to create a world around them later in post. Finally, after the frustrations over the limitations of analog movie making, George's imagination would be unfettered. He fought for years to have total control surrounding the release of his films. Now he would have total control of everything within the frame, too. Episode II's release on over 3,000 screens across America helped it achieve a total gross of $635 million, although that would eventually make it the least successful of the new movies. George would temper his disappointment by throwing himself straight into making his final Star Wars movie, Revenge of the Sith. But George feared that it would be too dark and violent for fans, hurting its chances at the box office. He was wrong. On its release on May 16, 2005, Revenge of the Sith would create a single-day ticket sales record of $50 million, going on to a worldwide total of $848 million. George was delighted and relieved. The Star Wars saga was finally at an end, and he could begin thinking about what he wanted to focus on next. But as George made the rounds in the press to help promote the final film, one question kept coming up.
What if someone else beside you came to you and said, "I want to make Episode 7? Could you see that happening?
No.
No, absolutely, positively, you're really closing the door without any wiggle room whatsoever.
Right. There is no Episode 7.
George now found himself at a crossroads in his life and career. The empire in his Star Wars movie had been vanquished, but his own personal empire was still growing. The vision of Skywalker Ranch as a filmmaker's paradise continued with more land purchased and more production facilities planned. George was moving away from blockbuster movie production, but there remained the question of where his ambitions would take him next. A clue to the answer lay in his past, in those happy family visits to Disneyland, and giddy days spent riding the toy cars of Autotopia and fantasy trips to the moon. George's future lay in Tomorrowland.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's May 20th, 2011, in the Hollywood Brown Derby restaurant in Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida. As George Lucas settles into his seat, he looks around, admiring the caricature drawings of famous people that line the walls of the diner. Across from him is Bob Iger, Disney's CEO. George and Bob have been friends since the 90s, when as chairman of ABC Television, Bob had greenlit the Young Indiana Jones television series. Both men are in Orlando for the launch of the revamped Star Tours attraction. But George is unaware that Bob has an ulterior motive for this private conversation in an empty diner.
George, I think your guys at ILM and my Imagineer team, they've done a terrific job with the new ride. Well, we spent 2 years making sure it's something special. I think it's the best thing in the park. People are going to love it.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
PR people have set up a little skit for us at the opening ceremony. We're going to take to the stage wielding lightsabers and confront Darth Vader.
Do we have to say anything?
I have a line about Vader, about him preparing to meet his maker.
Okay, cute. Do I speak?
Yeah, some dialogue about getting R2-D2 to remove an energy shield that's surrounding the ride.
Okay, that's fine. You know, it's just a bit of fun. It won't take long. Easy stuff. While I've got you here, though, I wanted to say we're delighted to be in business with Lucasfilm. What does the future hold for you, George?
Well, the movies are done, but we've got the Clone Wars animation series headed for a fourth season now, and a very exciting live-action show called Underworld we're in pre-production on.
That's what's happening now, and I don't want to be fatalistic, George, but I'm wondering what happens down the road. You've got no heirs to run the company. Shouldn't you determine who's going to protect and carry on your legacy?
Well, it's funny, Bob. I've been thinking about that, too. You know, I've been talking to Steve Jobs lately.
George knew Steve after selling him Pixar back in 86, a company George still feels is his. So he had some pangs of envy when Steve turned Pixar into a hugely successful film company, eventually selling it to Disney for over $7 billion.
Yeah, Steve told me you've been asking about the Pixar deal, and it made me wonder, would you consider selling Lucasfilm to Disney?
George's eyes go wide. This is not where he thought the conversation was going. But he's intrigued.
Well, I am 67 now, and I've asked myself, how long do I want to keep doing this? But Lucasfilms, it's my life's work. If I were to let it go, it'd be on similar terms to the deal you gave Steve.
Well, George, you know, Pixar had 6 movies in development when we picked them up, all close to a go, ready to generate revenue and profits. They had a world-class team of engineers, directors, artists, writers, all of it to back it up. And we have Star Wars, Indiana Jones, ILM. Skywalker Sound is unparalleled in audio production. LucasArts has taken over the games industry.
I understand, George.
And of course, Lucasfilm has your extraordinary leadership skills at the helm. You're a visionary. But there's no product pipeline, not at the level of Pixar or Marvel. They've got 5,000 characters in their catalog.
In August of 2009, Disney bought Marvel Entertainment, too, for $4 billion. George admired Disney's aggressive expansion of the brand, which had seen the creation of the hugely popular Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, well, the Star Wars expanded universe has over 17,000 characters, Bob. There are books, computer games, animation series.
That's all true, but you said it yourself, George. There are no more Star Wars movies. But if there were some big, exciting projects in the pipeline, I think I'd be very interested in making you an offer.
Well,
Disney is the only company I'd entertain selling out to, but I'm not ready. No, I'm not ready to pursue that right now. When I am, if I am, I'd love to talk.
All right, George. Call me when you're ready.
When George took to the Disney World stage later that day, ready to open the Star Wars tour attraction, all he could think about was Bob Iger's offer. If George had ever wanted to retire, then Disney was the perfect company to sell to Bob Iger was someone George trusted to handle the negotiations. A plan began forming in George's head. He would install an ally to take the reins at Lucasfilm, then focus on setting up a new slate of Star Wars films to entice Disney to give him a good deal. If he could pull it off, he'd not only be one of the richest men in America, but also safeguard his future as the guardian of his beloved franchise. But to make that plan happen, George would have to move quickly. In early 2012, George set up a meeting with Kathleen Kennedy, an old friend who had produced all of the Indiana Jones films and someone George knew was a shrewd business operator. Over lunch in New York, George revealed that he was considering retirement. Kathleen's shock was nothing compared to what George said next. He wanted her to take over Lucasfilm, first as CEO and co-chair, and then, once George had secured his retirement plans, as sole head of the business. Kathleen agreed. She was duly announced as Lucasfilm CEO on June 1, 2012. The first stage of George's plan was in place. Now all he had to do was bring his beloved franchise back to life. George had stated on numerous occasions that there would be no more Star Wars movies. The six films he'd made encompassed the entire tragedy of Darth Vader's life and death. There was no more story to tell. But George's conversation with Bob Iger had shown him that Disney's interest in Lucasfilm was predicated on their being able to make more Star Wars movies. George knew that to maximize any offer, he would need to return to that galaxy far, far away. So he began writing, just a story outline at first, similar to how he began writing the initial Star Wars back in 1973. But he didn't just outline Episode 7. He laid out the story for a whole new trilogy. To help him tell the story, George would call on some old friends to help sway Disney towards buying Lucasfilm for the best possible price. In August 2012, George held a secret meeting with Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill to reveal his intention to make more Star Wars films. They were surprised, but more than happy to commit. The profit points George had given them over the years had made them both very wealthy and very loyal to George. Ultimately, even Harrison Ford, who was reluctant at first, agreed to come on board. George even brought back Lawrence Kasdan, who had helped write Empire and Return of the Jedi, to serve as story consultant. With a formidable troop of familiar faces ready to step up for more Star Wars, George felt ready to sit down with Bob Iger. In talks with Disney, George was adamant that key Lucasfilm personnel would have to be involved in any new Star Wars films. They had the expertise, born of experience, on handling the franchise correctly. George included himself in that group. When Disney bought Pixar and Marvel, Iger had been careful not to disrupt the creative teams who had gotten those companies to their vaunted positions. In the process, both firms had retained their brand identity. George sought similar assurances in his negotiations. George was the creator of the Star Wars universe, and he was loath to hand it over wholesale. But Iger was resistant to George's demand. Mindful of George's stubborn, overly hands-on reputation, Iger made it clear that if Disney owned Lucasfilm, then Disney would be calling the shots over all things Star Wars. As both sides continued to argue over control, George allowed Disney lawyers to audit the Lucasfilm back catalog to determine just what they might be buying. Disney needed to know how many characters were on offer, and more importantly, if there were any complex rights issues attached to any of those characters. Once the audit was complete and Iger was assured there were no rights concerns, George again pressed the issue of his own personal creative involvement in any future Star Wars. But Iger was clear. While they would be respectful of his opinion, Disney would not be beholden to George. The two men went round and round for months. George was conflicted. He was close to a deal, but Star Wars was his legacy in almost 50 years of his life. It had been fundamental in his pursuit of autonomy in an industry notorious for robbing the artists of their creative power. For George, control had been everything, the key to how he built his empire. His clashes with Warner Brothers over final creative control of THX 1138 and Universal over American Graffiti, and then his endless fights with Fox over Star Wars, all this conflict had been about George's vision being respected. All battles, hard fought, and eventually all won. George had risked it all on numerous occasions. He'd built Lucasfilm almost in spite of Hollywood, describing his company as a little mud hut outside the castle. For him, the movie business had once been filled with entrepreneurs and filmmakers. Now it was a respite of lawyers and accountants. A love of film had been replaced with a love of money. And George had railed against the corporatization of movie making, even as he struggled with the idea that Lucasfilm would become just another extension of a corporate behemoth. But Disney was different in George's mind. He'd loved them ever since his father took him to Disneyland on the park's opening week. Still, George knew his legacy was at stake. A lifetime's work that had seen relationships come and go, fortunes won and lost. Disney had their Magic Kingdom, George had Skywalker. The decision to sell or not weighed heavily on George. Finally, George made an attempt at compromise. He would sell, but only if his story treatments for episodes 7, 8, and 9 were part of the deal and formed the basis for the next trilogy. Bob Iger asked to read them first. George refused. In George's mind, the deal for Lucasfilm was, in reality, a deal for Star Wars, and as such, Disney would need to honor his vision. But still, Iger wouldn't budge. The impasse was finally broken when Iger agreed to purchase George's story outlines as part of the purchase of Lucasfilms. George interpreted this as a tacit promise by Iger to implement his ideas into the new films. George was finally satisfied that he could pass on the torch of Star Wars to a new generation of filmmakers. On October 30th, 2012, Bob Iger made the announcement.
Today, I am proud to announce the Walt Disney Company is acquiring Lucasfilm, the global entertainment company founded by George Lucas and the home of the legendary Star Wars franchise. In addition to getting the rights to one of the greatest family franchises and epic stories of all time, Disney is also acquiring all of Lucasfilm's operating businesses, including Industrial Light and Magic and Skywalker Sound. George Lucas is a true visionary and an innovative epic storyteller who has defined modern filmmaking with unforgettable characters and amazing stories. Fans can expect a new feature film, Star Wars Episode 7, in theaters worldwide in 2015. And there will be more feature films, as well as consumer products, television projects, games, and theme park attractions. We're thrilled that George has entrusted the future of his extraordinary legacy to the Walt Disney Company and recognize what an honor it is.
The agreed price was just over $4 billion, $2.2 billion in cash, the rest in Disney stock, making George the second largest shareholder at Disney. As George signed the deal, his face was expressionless. There was no sense of joy or remorse, just a handshake with Bob Iger and a few photos for the media. Inside, George was still conflicted. He knew he'd signed away his life's work, and he still couldn't be sure he'd done the right thing. But Iger had promised Disney would do right by Star Wars. George could only hope that that would be the case. It wouldn't take long for George to discover that what he and Bob thought was best for Star Wars were two very different propositions. George would not be silent on the matter, which would cause a very public spat between him and Disney. In the end, George had done the one thing he'd vowed never to do if he could help it. He gave up control for money. He would end up regretting it and paying the price.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
It's spring 2013 in George Lucas's office at Skywalker Ranch. George has invited Kathleen Kennedy, the CEO of Lucasfilm, up to Marin County. George has spent the past few months advising Disney on the Star Wars universe, outlining what characters can and cannot do, and he's keen to know how the script for the next Star Wars movie is progressing. So, George, things are really moving along with Episode 7. It's got a title. Finally, The Force Awakens. Oh, that's not bad. Sounds like an old Republic serial. Disney wants it in theaters in 2015. Oh, God, that's fast. I tried to push for a year, but Bob Iger insisted. But now that JJ is on board, I'm sure it can be done. Filmmaker J.J. Abrams has been tempted over from another franchise, Star Trek, to produce and direct the newest movie. Well, you know, I think he's a great choice. I've got no complaints there. Yeah, and he's delighted to be working with Lawrence Kasdan to get the script right. Lawrence, we're really helping make it an authentic Star Wars movie. Well, I am excited. I want to see what you've done with my outlines. About that, George. I'm sorry, but we've decided to go in a different direction. What does a different direction mean? That was one of the conditions of the sale. My story outlines were the basis for the new trilogy. Well, Bob still sees a lot of potential in them, but there's a feeling at Disney that your suggestions are a bit out there. George is furious. This is the first he's heard of a change in plans. He'd believed his ideas would be instrumental in creating the new trilogy, but it's clear he's being sidelined. Out there? Kathleen, my outlines are a natural extension of the story I've been working on for 50 years. You can't ignore them. Well, George, no one gets the story. What is a midichlorian? They're microbiotic beings that feed off the Force. But I guess that's what I'm talking about, George. It's esoteric. Fans don't want microbiotics. They want lightsabers. Yeah, fans. You know, some fans hated The Phantom Menace. And that didn't stop us making almost $1 billion at the box office. Don't you think I know what I'm doing? I'm sorry, George. Bob thinks Episode 7 could be a $4 billion picture if it's done right. And we need it done right. George was devastated. But there was nothing he could do. There was no contractual obligation for Disney to abide by the story outlines. Just an unwritten agreement that the outlines George had sold would be considered. So with George out of the picture, Disney could press on with their plans. Any potential concerns Disney might have had that Star Wars Episode 7 would struggle without George's input were quickly dispelled when an 88-second trailer was released in November 2014. Within a week, it drew 100 million views online. When their first film, The Force Awakens, was released on December 18, 2015, it broke box office records. Opening on over 4,000 screens in North America, it took $120 million on its first day. By December 27th, less than 10 days later, it had already taken $1 billion at the global box office and would go on to become the third highest grossing film of all time, taking $2 billion. But the success did not stop George from feeling hurt and betrayed. When he appeared on the Charlie Rose TV show on Christmas Day 2015, he wasn't shy about making his feelings known.
They decided they didn't want to use those stories. These are my kids. So
all those Star Wars films.
All the Star Wars films.
George was pained by Disney's rejection of his ideas. And when he finally saw Episode 7, he was severely disappointed. His Star Wars films had always pushed technological boundaries. In that regard, he saw nothing new in this Star Wars. But emboldened by The Force Awakens' success, Disney went into overdrive. And by 2019, five new Star Wars movies, including the new trilogy, had been released, collectively taking over $6 billion at the box office. Then, with the introduction in November 2019 of Disney Plus, the company's streaming video service, a new outlet for more Star Wars content was born. Disney Plus launched with a new Star Wars show, The Mandalorian, as the jewel in its crown. By April 2021, just 17 months after its debut, Disney Plus had signed up over 103 million subscribers and moved ahead with its vigorous expansion of the franchise, announcing 11 new Star Wars series in September 2021. Left behind in all of this was George. He appeared on the set of The Mandalorian a couple of times, but only as a curious onlooker. George appeared to have little to do with the new universe of Star Wars material, although with 37 million Disney shares as part of the deal, he certainly benefited. When he inked his contract with Disney, stock price stood at about $50 a share, but the combined success of the new Star Wars movies and Disney Plus saw their value increase to four times that amount within 10 years. George's shares gave him a twice-yearly dividend payout of over $30 million, which meant that alongside his $2 billion in cash from the sale, George was able to smoothly transition to a new chapter in his life. In June 2013, 1 month after George turned 69 years old, he married Melody Hobson, a prominent business leader. 2 months after that, he was a father once again, and he and Melody welcomed Everest Hobson Lucas into the world. Beyond his family pursuits, George turned his attention to philanthropy. He had earned so much in pursuit of his dreams that he felt it was time to start giving back. He had already donated $1.5 million in 1999 to his alma mater, the University of Southern California. That money was designated for the creation of a digital filmmaking studio. But it was well surpassed with his next donation, a gift of $175 million to USC. Further gifts to other institutions and the creation of an educational foundation to support innovation in schools followed, but George felt he could give more than just money. Over the years, he'd amassed a huge collection of paintings, photography, sculpture, movie posters, and of course, Star Wars memorabilia. What he lacked was a dedicated place to display them all, but he knew the perfect place where they could be shown, a Lucas Museum. It would take years of negotiations before it was finally agreed that the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art would be situated in Exposition Park, Los Angeles, less than a mile away from where George's filmmaking career began at USC. It's planned to open in 2023. In 2021, Forbes magazine listed George Lucas as the 124th richest American, with an estimated wealth of $7 billion. The 18-year-old, who'd once rejected his father's plans for him to run the family store, had ended up running one of the biggest stores of all. And he'd done it by stubbornly fighting for control, by gambling on himself, not being intimidated by risk. And every time that risk paid off, he went right back and did it again. He'd taken a distrust of big business and become one of the biggest businessmen of all. And all of it was thanks to Star Wars, a franchise that by 2021 had earned over $10 billion from its movies and in excess of $32 billion in merchandise. And just like the plans hidden in R2-D2 that bring about the destruction of the Death Star, perhaps a similar secret message is to be found in Luke Skywalker's journey too. The actor Mark Hamill certainly thought so.
If you write my character's name out and just use the first initial, it's Luke S. No one could ever guess that a guy like that could come in and bring all of Hollywood to its knees. Hollywood as the Death Star and George as the conquering hero.
2021 marked 50 years of Lucasfilm, the company George set up to take on Hollywood and make his cinematic dreams a reality. In tribute, the toy maker Hasbro announced a new 6-inch Stormtrooper action figure that, when its helmet is removed, reveals the likeness of a white-bearded, 77-year-old George Lucas. From Wondery, this is episode 4 of George Lucas, Creating a Hollywood Empire. On our next episode, Lucas biographer Brian J. Jones explores George's life and legacy. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about George Lucas, we recommend George Lucas: A Life by Brian J. Jones, Skywalking by Dale Pollack, and How Star Wars Conquered the Universe by Chris Taylor. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Ayad Andrews. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship, and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.